The Metal Mentality Podcast is brought to you in partnership with AM300 and the Phoenix Project. For more information on both, check out am300.com/metal.
I felt alone, like I was trapped in a cold, dark room.
I will be the last to fall.
It seemed as if I felt a ray of light.
I won't shed a tear for them to see.
In a world overwhelmed by darkness, how does one move into the light?
And it gave me the strength to break free.
I will be the last to fall.
Hell has lost its power. Be metal and stay metal with consistency. Continually choosing to make choices for a better future. Fortitude. Having courage while overcoming obstacles. Grit. Perseverance of effort combined with passion while working towards being better today than you were yesterday.
Once I broke free, I never intended on going back. But I had made a promise that if I ever found my way out, I would return and fight to liberate those still trapped inside. You are not alone. Rest assured, I will be the last to give up.
These are metal-minded individuals, and these are their stories. You're listening to the Metal Mentality Podcast. Now, here's your host, Preston Ewell.
All right, welcome to the show today, everyone. Man, I am so excited for this. Oh, man. Every once in a while, you get to talk to someone who just blows your mind and is not just accomplished incredible things, but is also just an incredible human being. And that is my guest today. My guest today is Colonel Retired Meryl Tengesdahl. She is the first African, the first and only African-American woman to ever fly the U-2 spy plane. Now, if you don't know much about this plane, it's the most difficult plane to fly in the world. It flies at ranges up to 70,000 feet. And the pilot is basically wearing a spacesuit. And we're going to talk about this, how she got there. I'm so excited. Meryl, how are you doing today?
I'm doing awesome. How are you?
And, you know, given quarantine is unique. And if those watching this video interview, I am recording live, which is everything's recorded live, but from my kids' playroom. And my wife took my kids out, and she's like, I don't know how we're going to do these interviews when you were in quarantine. So if you can do them at night, that would be great. I'm like, I'll do that from now on. But yeah, it's been pretty difficult, this quarantine thing. I won't lie.
Well, we could have did a night thing, but it might have been like, I would have brought a disco ball or something, and we could have did the podcast from it. That would have been off the chain.
As long as you had disco music playing in the background, I mean, that's cool. I'm cool with that. All right. Well, so Meryl, you retired after 23 years in the United States military. Is that correct? That number?
Yes.
So let me just say this. So you're the first and only African American woman to fly the U-2 spy plane. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. Because I've seen conflicting things. It said one of two was another thing.
No. There have been currently, my knowledge right now, 9 women in the program. I'm not the first female, first African-American, first African-American woman, because there are probably about 9 or 10 African-Americans who've been through the program. So So, I mean, 65 years, you know, I talked about this in Ohio. This aircraft's been around for 65 years, and it's just a small percentage of people, of women or Black people have flown the aircraft. So it's just really small. And the cadre itself is small. I mean, maybe about 1,060, I'm guessing, right now, people, maybe 1,100.
Wow.
So 65 years. So it's small numbers.
That's pretty incredible. Wow. became an officer. You came in as an officer originally into the Navy. If all my research is correct, you tell me if I'm wrong. But in 1994, you commissioned into the United States Navy, started flying helicopters with them, and then went on to fly some fixed-wing aircraft, single engine. Many of those, from my can tell, there's a lot of different. What can't you fly? Let me just put it that way.
Yes, I've flown. Yeah, there's nothing I can't fly.
you're not even humble.
I'm not gonna be humble. I'm not gonna be humble about it. This is probably one of the few times that I'll be slightly cocky about it. There's probably nothing I can't fly.
Wow, that's incredible.
I'm gonna say confidently, not cocky, but I mean, I've flown helicopters, fixed wing, high altitude. I mean, I played video games, so I probably could do UAVs. I mean, I'm sure. So that won't be an issue with me. I like that stuff. So
awesome.
I like flying aircraft, and it's fun. It comes to me naturally.
Wow.
It's
I don't have a fear of flying, but I don't have a desire to learn how to do it either. I think it's just because I'm afraid I crash it.
Oh,
it's just not there. But that's when we'll get into that more about the difficulty of flying the YouTube. What's it called? The Dragon Lady? Is that what it's called?
It's called the Dragon Lady, yes.
I love that name. That's pretty cool. So let's talk about your path to getting there. Because being in the military, you're already going to be in the minority population of the United States. But being an African-American woman in the military makes you even more of a minority and an officer at that. Well, I want to talk a little bit about what led you to the military and the hurdles that you had to overcome with those things previously mentioned.
So, I mean, what led me to the military, you know, someone, you know, I was born and raised in the Bronx. So in a place called Co-op City, to all my Co-op Cityites out there, what's up? And, you know, I came from a middle-class, single-family household. My mom worked. Most of the time, she worked in the post office, so government service as well. So we didn't have a lot of money, and I always wanted to fly. I wanted to be an astronaut. Most people, if you did some research, you know the thing that motivated me was Star Trek. I was a sci-fi person. I wanted to be an astronaut. I wanted to explore space. And when I was 7 or 8, I made that choice. And I tell people, believe it or not, at 7 or 8 years old, in my mind, I had a framework for how he's going to get there. Like, I knew I was going to do well in math and science, even though I had not taken much of that. And I knew I was going to go to college and do something scientifically and then be a pilot. At that time, in my mind, it was commercial. But as you get older and reality sets in and you can't afford it, you go, what are the other ways to do that? And the military is an option. And as I grew older, the military resonated with me more just for the fact that even if I wasn't a pilot, I would have joined the military for a minimum of 4 years because I thought it was something that we all should do, serve our country in some capacity. It doesn't have to be the military. So that led me to going to college, getting a degree in engineering. I had some things during high school where I did a lot of math and science programs. I did some engineering studies, in particular electrical engineering, in high school, which led me to getting a degree in electrical engineering in college. And after that, I had to choose what branch of service. So Air Force and Navy were on my top choices. And actually, most people don't know, I was in the Air Force ROTC at my University of New Haven, for 2 years. And during those 2 years, I felt that the Air Force was not in line with what I wanted to do personality-wise. It's funny how you come full circle. And I decided the Navy would be the best choice. And that's what I pursued.
That's incredible. My uncle retired 20 years from the Navy. When I joined the military, the first recruiter I spoke with was a Navy recruiter. They shared a storefront office with the Air Force, and I talked to both of them. And when I was in my juvenile years, I got into some trouble with the law, and they said, yeah, no thanks. And then there was a Marine who walked in. He said, let's talk. And I went and talked to him. I was like, yeah, I don't really like crayons. They don't taste very good. I ended up talking to an Army recruiter and going in the Army. But I joke about that. But no, we appreciate the Marines. My brother-in-law is a Marine too. But
I love the Marines.
Yeah, they're good people.
One interesting thing is when I decided I was going to join the Navy, trying to find a recruiter was difficult. When I was back in the Bronx and I had got my degree, I reached out to a couple of Navy recruiting stations in New York City, and they were all like, oh, we don't have any pilot slots, but we have, you know, we have these slots for you to be a corpsman or, you know, pick a enlisted rate. And I go like, no, I want to be a pilot. And everyone was telling me no. And at the time I was dating a gentleman who was in the Navy. He was a corpsman, he was enlisted. Don't tell anyone, but he was enlisted at the time and he was about to get out, and he reached out to a recruiting district in San Diego. And he told me to call him, and I called I think it was Navy Lieutenant at the time. And he says, hey, if you could get out to San Diego and pass the test, we'll get you a pilot slot. And he was blunt about that. And I was like, oh, wow, word, okay. Let's do this. So I took a four or five day bus trip from New York to Yuma, Arizona, because my boyfriend at the time was stationed at Yuma. He was a corpsman for working with the Marines. So I went out there, and then Yuma, Arizona is right at the border of California, very weird area out there. And I went over to San Diego and took the test, met this recruiter. I took the test, passed, and then we started putting my package together. In the meantime, I spent about 2 months out in Yuma, Arizona, and I picked up a job at Godfather's Pizza, delivering pizzas. And every time I got to the flight line, oh my gosh, I would just so annoy the maintenance guys out there. I'm like, hey, can I see the aircraft? Can I check the aircraft? Can I look at the aircraft? So I was looking at Harriers the whole time and just like, man, can't wait. Like, I was so excited about it, delivering pizza as a 22-year-old.
You're looking at your future, and then you're in your delivery uniform. That's how I pictured it. You're like,
yes.
The pizza girl's like, hey, I'll bring you some extra breadsticks if you let me sit in the cockpit.
Yeah, I did. It was just fun because I love being on the flight line, and I knew, man, If I get a pilot slot, if I get picked up, this is gonna be an awesome thing.
Oh, that's incredible! So, you get into flight school, right?
Yes.
What happens next? Hey, was that obviously flight school is not an easy thing? Did you have any particular challenges that might be unique to you?
So in the 90s. 94, I got commissioned. During that time, and the recruiter told me, they were really looking for minorities for the aviation programs, any type of aviation programs. There were not a lot of minority representation across the services, especially in aviation. So when I went to Officer Candidate School and API and then subsequent flight school in Corpus Christi, it was very interesting because there were a lot of Black people in the program, and it was actually kind of nice. It was a huge group of us. During that time, when you had instructors, not the military instructors, but the instructors that work the simulators, those are the older gentlemen, usually from the Vietnam era or the older era. I think they were kind of surprised by that, or taken aback by that influx, because some people didn't really appreciate maybe the presence of minorities, whether they would be Black people or women, because there were more women also, because they were looking to recruit more. And nothing is ever overt about it. No one says, hey, I don't want you here. But you could tell in the way one would respond to you vice maybe another student. And just being who you are, it's, you know, some people don't like change. And that's just how it is sometimes. People are a little closed-minded, even in the military. It just happens.
Yeah. No, I think I agree. We don't like change.
No one does.
Nobody does, right? Like this whole quarantine thing we're going through right now, like we're all readjusting all of our priorities in our life. I think that's probably the most drastic change that everyone can relate to and how it's affected our lives.
Changes so you can, you know, change is something, you know, I'm growing up with that I had to deal with for a long time, and how to deal, you know, for military people, yeah, change is going to happen. It's inevitable. That's why we train so much. And that's why we develop this foundation for us. So when change does occur, we don't either shut down or flip out or have all this anxiety. We should fall back on our training. And I think growing up in the Bronx, for me, the training was, you know, I grew up in a single parent household. I'm an only child. My father left when I was 7 or 8. So that's a lot of change for a kid. I see, you know, even now as an adult, I see what happens when parents get divorced and their kids, you know, how they deal with that. And how I dealt with that was, hey, I'm going to look at, I'm not going to internalize it. I'm not going to lash out. I'm going to focus on things that I can control. Whether it's in school or whether it's just doing sports. I like to do a lot of sports that kind of help through that. Or even looking at sci-fi, which may be there's some correlation when I was younger. As you get older, how do you deal with change when you become a when your mother can't be home and you become a latchkey kid? Back in the 80s, latchkey kids were huge, right? So how do you deal? You could give me a paper and a cardboard box and I'll entertain myself for hours and days being by yourself after you do homework and not getting in trouble. So I think it's the same here. When you go to flight school and people don't particularly care for your presence for one reason or another, how do you deal with it? Well, you stick your head down, you get in the books and you do work and you be the best that you can at that time. You can't control the fact of how they feel. You can only control how you respond to that. Understand?
That's very similar to something about one of the points I've been trying to drive home on the show is you can't control your situation. You can't control what happens to you. The only thing you have control over is your response and how you emotionally react to that.
Yeah. How you react and what training or what has happened in your past that you could fall back on. What are the things that are in your control that you can do? I could control how much I study the aircraft systems. I could control how much I know the aircraft inside and out when I sit in that cockpit, the simulator, and I handle emergencies. I could do all that. If he doesn't like me because of my outer shell, well, too damn bad. I'm just going to try to impress him with the knowledge of the aircraft and show him that I'm required to be here as much as anyone else.
I like that. Just show them, don't lash out, but lash out in the way of like, I'm going to show you I have a right to be here. I'm going to show you why you should treat me with respect other ways. Yeah, not just the respect that we should give to human beings in general.
But. And it was great at the time because of the group of people that were there. We were able to support one another because, again, maybe some people saw it overtly, and I'm sure they did. I could feel it, but no one, only there was one instance when an instructor was incredibly harsh, but maybe that's just the way he was. So again, we had a good support system and a good group of people, both of color and both, you know, black, white, male, females in our group of pilots or student pilots. I mean, we're all struggling together. We're all getting our butts handed to us on a daily basis in the briefing rooms. So, I mean, there is this, you know, you build this camaraderie with your fellow students, like, dude, you just got hammered, you know, well, you kind of stick together. So, yeah, that's another good thing.
Yeah. And that, I think that, that the importance of having support, not just in a training environment, but in life for whatever situation you're dealing with, whatever you're handling, it's really important that you have, people that are supporting you, don't isolate yourself. Cause I imagine, if that wasn't there for you, that group wasn't there for you, that would have been a much more difficult situation to overcome and excel at. But, even in life, when life gets hard,
it would have
got to have it. You got to have that help. You got to have someone there you can turn to, someone you can talk to, someone who can say, yeah, that's this sucks. Like, I agree. your situation's really crappy, but hey, like, let's get through it. And that's not just in the military. It's everyday life. Every one of us are going to go through difficult times that we need support and help with.
Right. So, so flight school was a challenge, but I would tell you the other thing, other than the external forces that you, can't control and you have to do your best. I would say my instructor, who I had my on-wing at the time, for those who don't know, in the Navy, you get assigned an on-wing who kind of takes you through the first phase of your flying up until solo. And he was incredibly hard on me. He was hard on everyone. He was known in flight school as a screamer. At the time, I don't think instructors really scream anymore, but I would get in the cockpit and he would proceed to curse me out pretty hard for hours on end. And then when we get out of the cockpit, he would act normal, like, oh, well, you know, he just had this Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde face. But very hard. There were times when I felt like quitting. I didn't take it personal for him, but he was just difficult. And it was a great thing because we developed this relationship and this good mentor-mentee type of relationship. And this instructor, he was a white guy. He went by the name of Gramps, white hair at 29, Southern gentleman, had a Southern accent. He still lives in Virginia with his family. We still keep in contact. But I remember when it came down for selection, regardless of all the external influences, you still internally sometimes doubt yourself. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you don't know. You know, I joked in the beginning saying there's nothing I can't fly, but there was a point where I was doubting my abilities, doubting if I could do this, doubting if I could finish the program, doubting if I would be good at jets, if I'd gotten jets, because that was such a big focus in flight school, getting jets, getting the aircraft you want. And I remember during the selection piece, I told my on-wing or my instructor at the time, he goes, I was like, I'm doubting my abilities. And I remember him saying to me, he goes, people will say a lot of things about you and they'll look at you and they'll assume a lot of things because you're black, because you're a woman, because you're here because of diversity reasons or quotas at the time. That's what they used, the word quotas. And he said, you're going to perform really well. He said, you're one of the best students I've ever had, as hard as I was on you. And he said, you're going to perform well, and there's going to have to be a point in time where those people cannot say that you're here because you're black, because you're here because you're a woman. They're just going to have to say you're here because you're just that damn good. So I've always taken that, even 25 years later, I've taken that with me, because there's a point where you're just that damn good and no one can't say anything about you. They can hate on you all you want, but at the end of the day, you're going to outperform. You're going to perform well. So you can't be your own demon in a way, or be your own obstacle. You know, listen, the good thing is that he put those words in my head and I kept that with me.
Yeah, it's really powerful. Just believe in yourself, believe in your abilities. That's key to overcoming any obstacle, I believe. Well, you might be one of the most metal women I've ever had the pleasure of meeting. You're right up there with Kirsty Ennis, my last guest, who has one leg and hiked Everest. So
I know, I was listening to that. She was impressive. And she said something. I was like, you're insane, but I like it. you're crazy.
You're crazy, but I love the level of crazy you got.
Yeah, it's just one of those. You know, she has that bug to do a lot of great things. I mean, me personally, I've had one hip replaced. I got to get the other hip replaced. So when she was talking about climbing, I was like, I felt my hip starting to throb going, no way. There's no way I would do that.
Yeah. That's incredible.
Hey, everyone. I just want to take a minute to tell you about an amazing nonprofit organization doing incredible things for others. As you may remember, I had the privilege of interviewing Kirsty Ennis in episode 18. She is an individual with some true grit and just some real metal. And she wants to give that same mentality to other people who are struggling. The Kirsty Ennis Foundation's mission statement is to inspire individuals to stubbornly climb the mountain in front of them. We aim to show the world that we control our circumstances. They do not control us. This is awesome. That's what this entire show is about. It's about finding that mountain in front of you and overcoming it, using what you're struggling with as a catalyst to become a better version of yourself. What's really cool about this foundation as well is they have 100% volunteer-based staff. Nobody gets paid, no salary. All the money that is donated to the foundation goes to the programs that they have to take people outdoors and use outdoors and mountain climbing as a process for healing and becoming better versions of themselves. So what they do is they financially support other deserving nonprofits through a grant application cycle that they do. And when they go on these climbs in these other countries, these mountain climbs, they recycle medical devices such as wheelchairs and prosthetics for the local people who live in the countries where they're doing these climbs in the mountains. It's incredibly awesome. I encourage you to check out their website, www.kirstyennisfoundation.com. See if this is the right fit for you, if this is something you would like to donate and be a part of to change the lives of other people.
So those times that you said that you felt like you wanted to quit, yeah. How did you get through that? And I guess I define that as grit. When you don't know what else to do, just dig deep and you find that grit. You rely on your metal. How did you find that? Where did it come from?
Gosh, I remember the day with the same arm when he was yelling at me in the aircraft or something. I don't know what I was doing. But I remember putting my head down going, man, if I just open this canopy, I can really just jump out of it. Because I was so tired of being yelled at. And so how many ways I could totally screw up, a simulated engine failure pattern. And I remember he yelled at me saying, keep your head up. Stop putting your head in the cockpit. I can't see past you. Or he was yelling at me. And we landed. And at the end, I started doubting because I was starting to have like nightmares of flying. And I don't know what made me stay in the program. Dude, I didn't want to be a quitter. I was like, screw this. I'm just going to finish. He's going to have to kick me out for this to happen. Dude, I will not quit on something. That's one thing I know about me. I will not quit. I do not want to be that person that says, man, I should have or could have or would have. I just go do it until I can't anymore. It's a switch that I just flip and go, hey, I'm not going to give up on this. I'll look for help, or I'll look for an outlet to vent my frustrations, whether it's working out, whether it's hitting a bag, whether it's doing martial arts. But then once I get that frustration out, I seriously think about, okay, what's the plan of attack? Because what I'm doing is not working right now. So how can I change what I'm doing to become successful? And I've always been like that. I am not successful the first time that I do something. There are times that I am, and it's great, but the times that I'm not, I'm just like, you need to dig deep. You need to suck it up. Whatever emotional feelings you have your single emotional event with whatever inanimate object that you need to do, and then you need to freaking get back in there. So that's what I think of. It's like, you need to get back in there and start freaking getting back to the grind and figuring a different way to overcome this.
I think that's the difference between failure and success. A failure would be defined as like, I can't do this. I failed the first time. I'm done. I'm not ever going to try this again. But what you're saying, you go back, you look at it, like, what do I have control over? What can I change? And then you take that knowledge from that experience of that failure and you apply that to try something different. I think that that's success. And I think there's a lot of negative connotations around the word failure. And we use failure as an excuse to quit trying. And when we fail at something, then we will identify with that and say, I'm a failure because I failed at this. Versus, right. Yeah, and I failed. Yeah, okay. But what can I learn from this? What can I take from this to be successful the next time I attempt this?
So you have kids. Mm-hmm. You have young kids. Nothing pisses me off more than when my 7-year-old is doing a problem and then he starts whining about it. Or he says, I can't do it, and he wants to give up. Dude, he looks at me and he knows I'm about to open up a can on him. And I go, you're going to do it again, and you're going to do it another 3 times. And then you can see this tear starting to well up. I'm like, no. I was like, you could do this. Take a deep breath. Let's see I want you to think of a different way of how to approach it. And he'll sometimes fight me. And I'm like, nope, I won't let him off the hook. I said, maybe your teachers at school do, especially now we're homeschooling. I'm like, you're with mom now. You got a whole bunch of life lessons to learn.
We don't quit.
No, I was like, yep. I was like, and then when he gets it, you could see the pride in him. You could see how happy he is, and he's just like, ah, yes, I got it. And I'm like, see, wasn't that bad. He goes, okay. And he'll hit the next problem.
That's awesome. It's awesome. You're instilling those character traits in your son at this early age so that he can go on and accomplish great things and help the world be better. Because if you are always going to quit, you're never going to help anything, yourself or anyone else in the world. Yeah, it's you have to be consistent. You have to have that grit.
Yes, you have to. I guess it's maybe the art of persevering, right? So it's the art of just getting through as hard as it could be. Right now with COVID going on, there's a lot of feelings going on, a lot of feelings that people have. And some people are like, hey, I'm still in my pajamas at 12 o'clock. And if they tell me that, I yell at them. I'm like, get dressed. I'm like, get into a routine, do a little workout, start getting your mind on how you can still excel during these times, whether it's at home doing a podcast, whether for me it's doing stuff online because now I'm a personal trainer. How do I reach my audience? How do I do those things? Or me doing a podcast, talking about my story. How do I still motivate and influence people during this time?
Yeah. How do we motivate others when we ourselves are still having a hard time? Because here's what I found is you don't have to have all your problems solved. You don't have to be completely fixed to help other people. You just use the knowledge that you have to help someone else. Because none of us are perfect. We're all works in progress our entire lives. And if we believe that we're not, then we're failing as human beings.
Absolutely. I always think most of us are a hot mess. And at any time, there's three levels for me. You're a hot mess, you're a dumpster fire, or you're Chernobyl. So most of us at the time, hot mess, yeah, it's just daily life. My son could put me in that hot mess state at any time. Dumpster fire is your world is on fire and everyone's watching and you're contained right now, but everyone's watching. It smells. It doesn't feel good like a dumpster and there's black smoke rising. And when you're Chernobyl, you've just taken out half of the people around you.
I like that. Imagine this explosion.
There's just a mushroom cloud and there's just
like, oh man, I've done that to people. We all go through that, you know?
Right. But I mean, even during this time, I mean, there's days that I wake up and I go, man, I just want to sleep another hour. But in my head, I'm like, you need to get up right now and you need to go work out and you need to do your routine and you need to get into that habit. Because certain people are counting on you to do that. And also, you've got to do it because you have a family that you're responsible for. Mm-hmm. And most of us are responsible for family, other family member, or other people, or other jobs that are important, doctors and nurses. So you've got to dig deep and you've got to realize that it's okay to be frustrated. It's okay to feel like that, but you still got to get up and give it your best at that moment. That's all you can do.
You got to show up. I took a class. It was a cultural geography class when I was living down in Texas, and I had no idea what it was. I just needed a geography credit, and so I took this class. And on day one, I walked in, and this teacher was like this weird hippie lady from the 60s, 70s. She was super, what's the word I'm trying to say? Extravagant, I guess. And I was like, this is going to be interesting. And on the board, she wrote 80% of success is being present. I think it was Woody Allen that said it. 80% of success is being present. And she said, you could come to class every single day. And if you sit there and you don't take notes, you don't pay attention, it's pointless for you to be here. She said, but if you show here, 80% of the time, and that 80% of the time you're here, you're fully present and you take notes, she said, you'll get a B. 80%, that's a B. She said, everything else, more than that, just determines how much work you want to put into it. She said, show up and be present. So it's not just being there physically, you've got to be checked in. And that was one of the most impactful things I ever heard. And one of the few things I remember from when I was going to school there, the lessons. And I think about that all the time. It to be successful in life, a B is pretty successful. It's above average, right? Just 80% of the time, be present. And I don't think a B is good enough for me. I try to maintain that average, but I joke that I'm a mediocre person who just occasionally will do extraordinary things. But show that 80%, that's my cutoff line. If I'm not giving that 80%, and then I'm failing myself. Yeah, so I like what you're saying there. But we're running short on time here, but I want to talk a little bit about flying when you find the YouTube plane. Talk to me a little bit about the difficulty of that. She's basically wearing a spacesuit, and I know that's really takes a lot of toll on your body physically. But I think the most important question everybody wants to hear about this is, have you seen any UFOs?
You're probably like the umpteenth person has asked me that.
I know.
No, I have not seen it. No UFOs. I say maybe I was mistaken as one, but no UFOs.
Dang. All right. So
I think the coolest thing I've ever seen was a shooting star go beneath my aircraft.
Oh wow, that's incredible.
And It was over California, dark night, and it was probably the parallax, but nevertheless, it was cool as hell, and I enjoyed that. Yeah. That made me realized, it's one of those moments you have that, damn, my job is cool moments.
Yeah, that would be. I get excited on the ground seeing a shooting star. I'm like, hey, look, a shooting star.
And yes.
You're like, hey, look, the pointing down.
And I was like, huh. I was like, that's pretty cool.
And at that moment, I'd be like, I'm legit. Yep. This is awesome.
How I felt.
So my next question, though, is what do you want to tell all the flat earthers? Because I know you see the curvature of the earth, right? At 70,000?
Yes.
What do you want to tell anyone who wants to argue the earth is flat?
All you flat earthers, wrong. You're wrong.
Wrong.
That's all I got to say. One word, wrong.
There you go. I bet there's gonna be like a little buzzer, like,
Try again.
That was funny. Yeah. So.
I enjoy the YouTube. One, you have to, number one, you have to apply for the program and you have to get accepted into the program. It's one of the few programs that you have to interview for. 2-week interview process. I know they're changing the rules on that right now. They may take a flight student that is newly winked into the program. I think they're going to start trying that out. Not sure if that's happened yet. But the YouTube resonated with me in terms of the mission that it performs. Reconnaissance. We did a little bit of that in the H-60 Bravos when flying the North Arabian Gulf. I like the fact it's a plug-and-play system where you have different sensors, so you have to know different sensors, just like the H-60, actually, because I had FLIR, I've had Hellfire, Penguin missile, all that stuff. The spacesuit aspect is great, but I like the reconnaissance aspect. I like the fact that we fly above and we provide products to the warfighter, the guys on the ground, the Army guys, the troops in contact. I like talking to those guys. I enjoy that aspect. When I went out to see the U2 cadre, the pilots, I liked their attitude. I liked their professionalism. I always joke and say that you have to be a little not quite right to fly the U2 because it's not for everyone. You're basically in a telephone booth. For all those millennials out there, the size of probably one of those smart cars in a pressure suit that's about, 30 pounds. You're cracking me up. Or I always say it's like sitting in the middle seat of a plane and the person on the aisle in the window are not sharing the armrest with you. That's what it feels like to be in the U2. Mm. Put a 30-pound suit on top of that. And you don't have a lot of movement. I enjoy that. So a lot of people don't. That's why they had the interview process. Some people put the suit on and they go, no way, Jose. The aircraft itself is very challenging. It suffers from adverse yaw. It has one engine, so it's single engine. And I enjoy doing single engine work. It's a finicky aircraft. Every aircraft does not fly the same. So there are some tail numbers, even to this day, I look at it and I would probably flip it off because every time I got in there, it would just give me such a hard time. You just work. I've seen this aircraft take people with 3,000 hours and make them look like it was their first day flying. Mm-hmm. It's an aircraft that you have to respect. It is the slowest aircraft to kill you quickly if you don't pay attention. So that's why I enjoyed the U2. I enjoyed the mission. I enjoyed the sensors. I thought it was great. I enjoyed the people, the brotherhood, the sisterhood that surrounded it. I mean, we deploy like a detachment would in the Navy. So it's a small group of people and, it was great.
I don't mean to laugh at anything you've accomplished. I'm laughing at your trying to explain to a millennial what a phone booth is.
I know you did.
It's so true. Like, what's a payphone? Like explain to my kids like what life was like before the internet, and they're like, "Wait, you had to watch commercials?" Like, yeah,
yeah. There's no concept of that. So yeah, I try to explain that.
Great, that's a great way to explain it. So, I know. Talk about the landing procedure of the YouTube, because as I was reading about this, I had no idea how difficult of a plane it is to land.
So the aircraft is difficult. One, the cockpit is small, so you don't have a lot of outside references to help you land. So when you're, and you exacerbate that by putting the suit on. You're coming back from your mission after 10 plus hours. You're tired, and now you have to stall an aircraft at 2 feet, so it doesn't land like a particular tricycle landing gear aircraft. You have bicycle landing gear. You actually have to keep the aircraft off until it stalls at 2 feet. So the tail wheel, which is the material made from a skateboard, touches down first, and then the nose touches down. That's a little counterintuitive to pilots who do flight training on tricycle landing gear systems. And once you land, you still have to keep the wings off the runway. So you still have to fly the aircraft until it comes down, until it slows enough where one wing can drop. You can't just land and drop a wing, because then you'll go off the runway. If you can picture that. I'm sure if you YouTube some YouTube landings, not so good landings, you see a lot of interesting things that have happened. So for me, I mean, the landing, that's where you make your money. That's what separates the good pilots from the bad pilots. After 10 hours, you've got to draw on whatever strength that you have left, and you've got to manhandle this aircraft down and look good doing it. Because if you stall it from 4 or 5 feet, you're going to break stuff on the aircraft. So the landing itself is challenging. It's I loved it because of that challenge, and I hope that answers your question.
No, it does. I forgot. I didn't know about the wing tipping part. I didn't.
No, when you see it, if you see some of the footage, the aircraft will roll, and then as it slows down, one of the wings will drop. There's a tail. There's a skid underneath, a skid plate underneath to protect the wing, and it'll come to a slow stop, and then you'll taxi off, and then you'll have maintenance come in with outrigger wheels called pogos that they'll attach to the end, and then you'll taxi back.
Oh, wow. So, well, we're about out of time here, but I have one final question for you. Let's hypothetically imagine that the next 30 seconds, whatever you wanted to say, would be heard by every person in the world. And there were no language barriers. What would you say? You got 30 seconds.
30 seconds. In our current state right now, of things that are going on, one, be focused, be compassionate, and be kind. Focused about what you're going to do every day, compassionate with other people, and understand that maybe other people are not as strong as you. Listen to them, be empathetic with them, try to understand them, try to walk in their shoes for a moment, and be kind by the way you treat them and handle with them. I mean, we got people walking around in masks, and people who are not, people who are angry, people who are sad. Just be kind to one another during these times. I think that goes a long way. And be focused on how you are going to live your life through these changes, how you're going to adapt to these changes, I think will help you tremendously.
It was great. No, it was a great. No, I appreciate that. Kindness and love and compassion are the most important things that we can offer. The most important thing we can offer anybody else. Thank you for sharing that. I really appreciate that.
Hey guys, be sure to follow the Metal Mentality Podcast on social media. And as always, if you find value in the show, please leave a review and rate us 5 stars on Apple Podcasts. But more importantly, share this podcast with someone you know who would benefit from the messages from the guests on each episode. You can find us on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter @MetalMentality.